So why do we die? I don't mean heart disease or cancer or stepping in front of a bus. I mean, how come we have to die? If you were making it up, would you make it up that we die? I mean, think about it. You get born, that's pretty traumatic. And then you got to do the diaper thing. That's not a lot of fun. And then finally you start having fun and they ship you off to school. And you go to school for what, 12, 16, 20 years? And then you ship you off to work. And you work for 40 years. And finally you can start having some fun and you die. What's going on here? Maybe we're doing something, maybe we're not doing something we should be doing. What if we hung a lot of crystals in the windows and, no, they do that in California, they still die. Maybe we're doing something we shouldn't be doing. Do you realize that over 90% of the people that ever ate food are dead? So, no, that's not going to work either. Well, one thing's for sure. If you don't get born, you don't die. And if you get born, sooner or later you're going to die. Of course, that only raises the question, why bother being born if you're going to wind up dead? But being born's a pretty popular thing. Like, everybody I know did it. Birds do it, bees do it. When it gets to be springtime, nature's just born and all over the place. So, yeah, why bother being born? It seems like Mother Nature has this urge to become. And that urge to become results in all these births. And the births eventually result in deaths. So this becoming, where does this becoming come from? Well, this building didn't used to be a building, right? Used to be wood and metal and glass. And then somebody stuck the pieces together and made it a building. It's the pieces being stuck together that makes it become a building. The clinging together of the pieces. Becoming seems to depend on clinging. And if there's becoming, there can be birth and then death. What about clinging? Where does that come from? Well, what do you cling to? I mean, if you had an old sock with three holes in it and somebody says, hey, can I have that sock? You're like, yeah, sure, you can have the sock, right? But if it's something really nice, more likely to cling to it. You cling to the good stuff. You cling to the stuff that you really, really want to have, right? The stuff you crave. So craving leads to clinging, leads to becoming, leads to birth, leads to old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, and despair, and all the rest of the dukkha. So this craving, when does craving arise? What do you crave? I don't know, chocolate, ice cream? You crave it because, well, it looks so nice and brown? I don't think so. You crave it because it tastes good. When you eat it, it produces pleasant vedana. We crave the things that produce pleasant vedana, and we crave for the absence of the things that produce unpleasant vedana. And all this craving, if we're not careful, leads to clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, and death. Well, these pleasant and unpleasant vedana, where do they come from? Well, if we take the chocolate ice cream thing, you go to the store, you see it in the freezer case. Does that produce pleasant vedana? Well, probably not pleasant enough that you're craving it. Well, maybe you remember what it's like, but, you know, it's not like, oh, I remember this tastes so good. Oh, it's so nice to stand here and look at it and remember this. No. You buy the stuff, right? And when they charge you money for it, is that the pleasant vedana? I don't think so. You take the groceries home, Let's hope you put all the other groceries away before you rip the top off the chocolate, right? Maybe you get a bowl, maybe you don't, you know, you stick the spoon in. Is it a pleasant Vedana when it's like really hard to get the spoon in? No, right? You finally get a spoonful of it. Pleasant Vedana yet? No. Ice cream hits the tongue. Contact. That's when the pleasant Vedana comes in. Contact leads to Vedana. If you're not careful, that'll lead to craving, clinging, becoming, birth, death. Well, what about contact? Contact arises because you left your senses hanging out in the environment. You're sitting in here trying to meditate and you left your ears on and somebody comes in and makes noise and you don't like it. Well, that's because you left your ears on and there's contact and it produces unpleasant Vedana and there's craving for it to go away. And that can lead to clinging, becoming, birth, and all the rest of the dukkha. So what about these senses? Well, they're part of having a mind and body. A mind and body with no senses would be, well, senseless. A mind and body with no senses would not survive. The senses, it turned out, are a necessary survival tool for your mind and body. You need them to navigate your environment, to get your nutrition, to avoid the hazards, etc. They're just part of having a mind and body. And the senses get sense contacts, and the contacts produce Vedana, and unless you're careful, the Vedana lead to clinging, craving, to craving, clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death. Well, this mind and body. Well, one thing's for sure, the mind and body doesn't work unless it's conscious. If you have a mind and body that's not conscious, and it stays like that, it's in a coma, and it winds up dead unless they force feed it or something. So mind and body is dependent upon consciousness. And having a conscious mind and body means you're going to have senses that get contacts. The contacts will produce Vedana, and unless you're careful, there'll be craving, clinging, becoming, birth, death. Well, what about consciousness? Consciousness arises due to the interaction of mind and body. Mind and body depends on consciousness, and consciousness depends on mind and body. In the suttas, it mentions they're like two sheaves of wheat leaning against each other. Each one supports the other. You pull one away, the other one falls over. So this mutually dependent consciousness and mind and body means that the senses are working, they get contacts, the contacts produce Vedana. Unless you're careful, the Vedana leads to craving, clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, and all the rest of the dukkha. This is dependent origination, paticca-samuppada. In one of the suttas, Sariputta, who is the Buddha's chief disciple, quotes the Buddha as saying, "One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination." It's really the heart of the matter. Now, the way I laid it out, there were 10 nodes with 10 links linking them together. This appears to be one of the early recensions or descriptions of dependent origination. In the connected discourses, the Samyutta Nikaya, as I mentioned, there are 56 different topics that are discussed. And one of the most important topics is dependent origination. And book 12 is on dependent origination. There's something like 95 different suttas on dependent origination in there. And in Sutta 65, the Buddha says that on the night of his enlightenment, what he discovered was these links of dependent origination. Sitting under the Bodhi tree, And he's made the vow he's going to sit there until he figures it out or the flesh rots from his bones. And so what's the question? Why do we die? Right? I mean, death is like the ultimate dukkha. Yeah? So why do we die? And what he discovers is, well, not so much why we die, but that if you're born, you're going to die, and if you don't get born, you don't die. Birth is a necessary condition for death. If you don't want to die, then don't get born. Of course, every single one of you made the mistake of getting born, so now you've got to deal with that. All right, so why do we get born? What's going on here? The Buddha wasn't looking for metaphysical answers. He wasn't so much looking for causes, like why do we die or why do we get born. He was looking for what we call necessary conditions. A necessary condition for the lights to be on is the switch be turned on. If you want to turn off the light, you just turn off the switch. Now, the switch being on is not a necessary, it's not a sufficient condition. The cord has to be plugged in. There has to be power coming to the wall socket where you plug it in. There has to be a power station that's generating the power, and the lines have to be intact. So there's quite a lot that the light depends upon. But if you can find something the light depends upon that you can manipulate, if you want the light off, you can manipulate that necessary condition. Turn off the light switch. The Buddha was looking for a necessary condition for dukkha, a necessary condition that he could turn off. So, old age, sickness, and death, a necessary condition is birth. But that's not one he could turn off. It's already happened. So, he starts looking for more things, and eventually he discovers craving. If you turn off the craving, the dukkha doesn't arise. Craving is a necessary condition for the arising of dukkha. Anytime you're experiencing dukkha, what you're experiencing is dissatisfaction with the way things are. You're wanting it to be different. You're craving for it to be different. If you can turn off that craving, then you don't experience dissatisfaction. It's just the way it is. You may know it's not the best way it could possibly be, but at least you're not suffering because it's the way it is. This was the Buddha's genius. Most spiritual teachings at that time were all about metaphysical explanations and either getting out of dukkha by being reborn as a god, or merging with Brahma, or never being reborn. You know, figure out some way to never come back. Remember, this is a culture where most people thought in terms of multiple incarnations. Reincarnation was a big part of the culture. Now, there were some teachers who said, nah, this is it. You're stuck here. You're going to suffer. You're going to die. The Buddha wasn't willing to accept that. So this dependent origination, these 10 links, what's it all really about? I mean, I've said they're necessary conditions. You find lots of different descriptions of dependent origination. The most common one, there's actually 12 links. There are two more added at the beginning. Basically, it starts with ignorance, not understanding what's really going on. And then, dependent on ignorance, there are sankharas. Sankhara is a very interesting word. It may be the most important word to understand in all of Pali. It means something that's made or manufactured. So this clock is a sankhara because it was manufactured. Your memory of the school you went to is a sankhara, because it's manufactured, it's made. In fact, it's pretty hard to find anything, any idea, any thought, any emotion that's not a sankhara. So the sankharas arise dependent on ignorance. And then consciousness arises dependent on sankharas. Consciousness requires an object. In early Buddhism, there's no such thing as consciousness without an object. You're always conscious of something, and the something is a sankhara. So sankharas are a necessary condition for the arising of consciousness. And then, as we saw, consciousness is a necessary condition for a functioning mind and body. The senses are dependent upon a mind and body that's functioning. Contact only occurs if there are senses, so contact has senses as a necessary condition. And so on up the chain. So what does it mean? Well, in the commentaries, they talk about dependent origination as happening over three lifetimes. The ignorance and the sankharas are your previous existence. In order to make this work, they take the word sankhara and they make it karmic formations, as opposed to fabrications or concoctions. Concoctions, an old-fashioned English word, means something that's made up. And so they say that the sankharas refers to your karma from your past life. Okay, so in your previous life you were ignorant and you acted in certain ways that produce karma. And now in your present life you have consciousness that's due to the previous life, and a mind and body, and the senses, and they get contact, and that produces vedana, and unless you're careful, you get craving and clinging, and that's the current life. And then the becoming, birth, and death is your future life. Because you were doing all that craving and clinging in this life when you die, then that's going to lead to becoming in a future life, and you'll be born there, and you're going to wind up dead there as well. All sounds very logical, except that I don't think the Buddha ever had that in mind. There's no place in the suttas where you can point to it and say, oh yeah, this is dependent origination, it's depicting three lifetimes. It's just not there. It's true, you can find a couple of places where maybe it's two lifetimes. All right, the becoming, birth, death is your next life, and all the others are the current life. But most of the scholars seem to agree that the places where you can find that are not the early descriptions of dependent origination, that it's later material. So we're back to the question, what does this actually mean? Well, there's a explanation of dependent origination by Ajahn Buddhadasa. As I mentioned, Ajahn Buddhadasa was one of the great forest monks in Thailand in the 20th century. And he says that dependent origination happens with every sensory input. It's not over multiple lifetimes. Every time there's a sensory input, you're getting dependent origination happening. I think he's onto something here. I'll give you an example. Let's say you've never had a mango, and you go to the grocery store and you're wandering around in the produce section and you see a sign that says mangoes, and you think, oh, I never had a mango, I hear they're good. So you wander over and you take a look, and there's this fruit, and you decide you're going to buy a mango, and you pick one out. Let's say you get a nice ripe one and you take it home. And then you figure out, okay, I think I need to peel this. And so you peel it, and you make a big mess, because that's what happens the first time you mess with a mango, right? All right, so you've got a mind and body, and you're conscious. Your senses are working. You cut off a piece of the mango. Contact, it hits the tongue. Followed by vedana, pleasant vedana. Oh, this is delicious. I'm going to have some more and some more. And you eat the whole mango and wow, that was great. I should get some more mangoes. Craving is setting in. In fact, my friends, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, they've never had a mango. I should turn them on to the mangoes. Right? So you get another mango, you go see your friends, you turn them on to the mangoes, and they're like, oh, cool, this is really good, wonderful. You've just given birth to the mango bringer. Because every time you go see your friends, you bring them a mango. And they're like, cool, a mango. And then after about five or six times, they're like, what's with the mangoes? Uh-oh, death of the mango bringer. So what's being born is your ego. You're, with each sense contact, you're experiencing the vedana, and if it's pleasant enough, you're craving and clinging and making a self, me, who wants this, who's got it, who's going to keep it, right? And so what you've got is a moment-to-moment creation of a sense of self. This makes far more sense to me than multiple lifetimes. And furthermore, it's quite a bit more useful because it's basically saying, pay attention to what's going on with all of your sensory inputs. Don't get caught up in the craving and clinging. That leads to ego formation. And the ego definitely can get you into trouble because the ego is the craver. And the clinger, and the craving and the clinging lead to dukkha. I think this is a far more useful explanation of dependent origination, but I don't think this is what the Buddha had in mind either. There's a sutta in the Sutta Nipata. I mentioned this is one of the oldest collections. It's in the Kutaka Nikaya, the miscellaneous collection. And so it's a book in there that has about 80 suttas in it. And in book 4 of that book, there are 16 suttas. And the 11th sutta there, so this would be Sutta Nipata 4.11, is entitled Quarrels and Disputes. Now, I mentioned this book before saying that the suttas here seem to be from very early in the Buddha's teachings. Remember King Bimbisara met the Buddha before he became enlightened and got the Buddha to promise to come back and tell him, you know, what he'd learned. And then about 3 years after his enlightenment, the Buddha came back to Rajagaha and gave a talk to King Bimbisara. At that point, the Buddha was first starting to collect monks and have followers. But for the previous 3 years, he'd been pretty much living on his own. So from the period from his enlightenment until he went back to Rajagaha, we have a picture of a solitary wanderer. And this is very much the picture we find in Book 4 of the Sutta Nipata. So most likely these discourses are very early and shows the Buddha's early thinkings. In this Sutta number 11 in that book, The Quarrels and Disputes, it's an early form of dependent origination. Someone asked the Buddha, why do quarrels and disputes arise? And the Buddha says, it's because people find things dear. They like them a lot. It sounds a bit like clinging, right? And then the questioner asks, why do people find things dear? Why do they like them a lot? Because of desire. Well, desire is kind of like craving. So, where does desire come from? It comes from, it is pleasant, it is unpleasant. Now, the word vedana doesn't appear. Okay, what appears is sat and asat. Okay, different words, but the same meaning. Remember, the vedana is the pleasant or the unpleasant. And this is also pleasant and unpleasant. And then the questioner asks, well, where does pleasant and unpleasant come from? Contact. The same as we have independent origination. And contact, it comes from mind and body. So the senses aren't mentioned. It appears the senses were added later because we find other descriptions of dependent origination that don't mention the senses. So mind and body. How do we get beyond mind and body? Well, now, in the regular dependent origination, it says mind and body is dependent on consciousness. But here it says we get beyond mind and body by changing our perceptions. We don't perceive in the ordinary way. We don't misperceive. We don't have abnormal perception. And we're not without perception. In other words, we're still getting sensory input, but we don't treat it the same way we usually do. This sutta is little known, but I think it's an extremely important sutta because it really tells us what the Buddha was thinking about, how he was looking at the world. That sutta, there's no way you could make it into a multiple lifetime explanation. There's just nothing in it like that. But it's looking at the problem of dukkha, stated as quarrels and disputes, and basically seeing that we get caught up in the things that we like and we cling to them and we crave them, and that arises because we find things pleasant or unpleasant. And the pleasant and unpleasant is just part of having sense contacts in a mind and body. And the way out is to change how we're reacting to the world. This is a much more important way of looking at dependent origination than the usual explanations. So, how come this explanation didn't become the standard explanation? Why the different words in the later explanations? Well, it turns out that the words in the standard explanation of dependent origination can be found in a Brahminical or a Vedic hymn of creation. In the Vedas, which are the earliest form of spiritual teaching we have recorded in India, there was the hymn of creation, a song about how the world came to be. And the ideas of ignorance, sankhara, consciousness, mind and body, senses, contact, vedana, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, death, all show up in the hymn of creation. It would appear that the Buddha got the idea of dependent origination, and after he had followers who were Brahmins who already knew the words for the hymn of creation, he just used different words. This was something he frequently did. He took words from some other tradition and he changed them around a little bit. We talked about the asavas the other night. The word asava shows up in the Jain religion. And it's the influxes. It's the bad karma, basically. And so you're to behave in a way so you don't get any bad karma. So when you die, you stay dead because you got nothing to come back for. All right? So the Buddha takes the word asava, but he uses it in a different way. It's the intoxicants of sense pleasures, of becoming and ignorance. So I think he did the same thing. After discovering that his monks understood the, or at least knew the words of the hymn of creation, he just took that and gave that the same meaning as his earlier discovery of dependent origination. So that's why we wind up with the words that we have. Now, there are some scholars that try and make a bigger deal out of this. I think they're off base. I think really we need to look at the earliest material to find out what's going on there. Dependent origination is not just these links, though. Often you find it taught as just the 12 links or the 10 links or whatever. But really, those are examples. They're important links that you should understand. Dependent origination is all about necessary conditions. Dependent origination in its broadest and most profound form is to see that everything that you encounter is dependent on other things. Nothing exists independently. You are dependent on, well, your parents having sex and getting a collection of genes and being fed and going to school and learning something. You're dependent now probably on your job. You're dependent on the air that you breathe, the air pressure that keeps you from exploding, right? You're dependent on your friends. I mean, if you didn't have any friends, you'd probably go crazy, right? So we're all dependent on other things. Who we are today is the result of a lot of previous things that happened. I mentioned earlier, we're speaking English because the British ran over to North America and ran off everybody else. So I wind up being an American and only know how to speak English. I'm sorry. So all these dependent conditions come together. We need to look at the world and see that everything is dependent on a bunch of other stuff. Now, it's not that everything is dependent on everything else, but that everything depends on a lot of other things. Maybe not everything else, but a lot of other things. We're dependent on the sun, right? We're dependent on gravity. I mean, if gravity disappeared, you better never jump up in the air. You just float off, right? Gravity is what makes the sun go, what keeps the earth in the orbit where water is liquid, which we're very dependent upon. Of course, the sun, it's dependent on gravity because that's what makes it have the nuclear fires. And the whole solar system came together because of gravity. The supernova that exploded to make all the particles that have come together to make us, you are all familiar that we're just stardust, right? You know, all that, those supernova exploding, that was gravity also. The Big Bang, who knows what that's caused by, but we're all dependent on the Big Bang. You start tracing it back, and the number of things that we depend upon is huge. The number of things that everything depends upon is huge. This is what the deepest teaching of dependent origination is about. In fact, when you really begin to get a sense of that, this sense of me as a separate individual begins to break down. This is where freedom lies. This penetrating this delusion of me as a separate entity. There's an interesting sutta in the Middle Length Discourses. It's number 38. It's the Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. It's actually a sutta that has multiple parts that have been joined together, which you often find in some of the suttas, but you can sort of figure out what's the early material. In that sutta, there's a monk by the name of Sati, the son of a fisherman. And Sati holds the view that his consciousness goes from incarnation to incarnation. And the other monks hear that Sati has this view, and they say, don't say that, Sati. The Buddha has many times said that consciousness is dependently originated. And although they discussed this with Sati and tried to convince him, he wouldn't let go of his pernicious view, his evil view. So those other monks went to see the Buddha and they told him what had happened. And the Buddha says, tell Sati the master calls. So that monk went and told Sati, "The master calls you, Sati." So Sati went to the Buddha, saluted, sat down at one side. And the Buddha says, "Sati, is it true that you think that your consciousness goes from incarnation to incarnation?" "Yes, venerable sir, as I understand the teachings of the Blessed One, my consciousness goes from incarnation to incarnation." And the Buddha says, "Sati, what is consciousness?" And Sati says, "It's that which thinks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions." This definition of consciousness might be something you've heard before, or something like it, perhaps. It's a very common understanding of consciousness, both in Buddhism and in other spiritual traditions, other New Age traditions, other Christian traditions. It's that which thinks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. The Buddha's reply is, "You foolish man, when have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma like that? Haven't I told you over and over again that consciousness is a dependently originated phenomena? Monks, do you understand consciousness like this monk Sati?" "No, venerable sir. Many times you have taught that consciousness is a dependently originated phenomena." "Good monks, it's good that you understand in this way. As for you, Sati, you will be known by your pernicious view for a long time." And here we are 2,500 years later, and we know about poor old Sati and his wrong view. The Buddha says, "I will question the monks on this." The Buddha says, "Consciousness is reckoned by the condition on which it depends. If consciousness arises dependent on the eye and forms, it's eye consciousness. If it arises dependent upon the ear and sounds, ear consciousness. Upon the nose and smells, nose consciousness. Upon the tongue and taste, taste consciousness. Upon the body and textures, touch consciousness. Upon the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness. Just like a fire is reckoned dependent upon the conditions on which it depends. If a fire is burning on a house, it's a house fire. If it's burning in a forest, it's a forest fire. If it's burning on rubbish, it's a rubbish fire. If it's burning on cow dung, it's a cow dung fire. It's the same with consciousness. They are dependently originated phenomena. I will question the monks on this." And then what follows is what is a series of questions and answers on dependent origination. It's called a catechism. And the Buddha asks a question about dependent origination and the monks answer. It's one of the most tedious portions of the entire Pali Canon. It appears to be a later addition to this sutta. The Buddha asked the monks some questions, and somebody who was preserving the sutta later threw in a few more questions, and then a few more questions, until it goes on for page after page of very tedious 12 links forward, 12 links backwards, 12 links arising, 12 links ceasing. But finally it gets to the point. And the Buddha says to the monks, and I think this is back to the original sutta, "Monks, knowing and seeing in this way," that is, in terms of dependent origination, "knowing and seeing in terms of dependent origination, would you run back to the past wondering, was I? Was I not? What was I? Being what? What did I become?" "No, venerable sir." "Monks, knowing and seeing in this way," in terms of dependent origination, "would you run to the future thinking, will I be? won't I be? What will I be? Being what? What will I become? No, venerable sir. Monks, knowing and seeing this way, would you be inwardly perplexed about the present, wondering, am I? Am I not? What am I? Where has this being come from? What will happen to it? No, venerable sir. Good, monks, it's good that you know and see in this way. Do you know and see in this way from your own experience? Yes, venerable sir. It's good that you know this from your own experience. So what the Buddha is saying is, don't think that there's some entity in here, some consciousness that goes from incarnation to incarnation. Notice that you are a dependently originated phenomena. You have arisen because of all these causes and conditions. That's what's happening. Truth is, there's nobody home. It's just causes and conditions coming to fruition. Don't think in terms of entities. Remember, we were talking about concepts earlier? When you think, I am, that too is a concept. When you think, I am separate from the other people or the environment or anything else, that's a mistaken concept. It's like the universe was right here and it poked up an eyeball, right? The eyeball's looking around. Actually, there's two eyeballs. It's got little microphones right here, right? And furthermore, this piece of the universe can move around on the surface of the universe. It's a mobile sensing device, okay? But it's just a piece of the universe. It's dependent on the rest of the universe. It's just not fixed in one place. And this mobile sensing device, while it's wandering around sensing the universe, looks down and goes, it's me, and thinks it's a separate part of the universe. This is the mistake that we make. This is the creation of the separate self. The Buddha says, don't do that. Look at the world in terms of dependently originated phenomena. The deepest insight that I got in all those months that I spent at the Forest Refuge was seeing that there's nothing but streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. That's all there is. There aren't any entities. There aren't any nouns, okay? We think they're nouns, you know, glass, bowl, person. It's all verbs. It's just some verbs move kind of slow, right? This didn't used to be a bowl. It used to be part of a rock. This didn't used to be a glass. It used to be sand. It's changing. This wooden table here, right? Used to be a tree. Somebody cut down the tree, made it into a table. We call it a table. If you're a leprechaun, it's a bus shelter, right? Okay? But because we're taller and we don't fit under it, we call it a table. If you're a giant, maybe it's a stool to sit on, right? Everything is a concept. And everything is dependent on other things. They're nothing but these streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. This is the heart of the dependent origination teachings. This is the heart of the Dhamma. We need to step outside of all these separate nouns and just see all these streams coming together, interacting, producing phenomena that we give concepts to, but all of it just continually carrying on. I'm just the intersection of a bunch of streams of dependently originated phenomena. But I act, and the actions that I do are more streams of dependently originated phenomena going out and interacting with other streams. I'm up here talking right now, that's producing a stream of words that you're hearing that maybe is changing how you will act or understand or think. And that will cause you to act in different ways. This is all just a big mass of these streams interacting. That's dependent origination.